doesn't do that now. What the only thing you have to do is launch it live, and then I've got to then flick over to the Facebook group and say, right, I'm going to go live now on there, and then the guys on Facebook can watch it. This is kind of how it works. A bit of a mess, I'm afraid. But hey, Brain Food Live is a mess, you know? That's how it is.
In terms of podcast platforms, though, is Crowdcast like a good one?
For live streaming, it's pretty much it. I think there's a couple of things you can do. There's other ones that allow you to, if you like, they're designed more for multi-stream. So if you want to create on one platform, but really you want to push it to YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, whatever. I've seen some other products being used. But for me, Crowdcast, it was useful simply because it's quite easy and you can pipe it into the Facebook group and you can do split screen. So one thing Facebook Live doesn't allow you to do is have people on split screens on the same thing, and it turns into a complete mess. Susanna Frazier is here. Isn't it like ridiculously early over there, Susanna? In fact, no, you might be in Amsterdam or something, aren't you? Susanna Frazier, by the way. Oh, 10 p.m. She's a great sourcer, by the way. By the way, Susanna, thank you for DMing me your slide deck. I'm very good chance I'm going to stick that into Brain Food this Sunday. If I remember, I'm a little bit hungover, so maybe I don't remember. But I will put it in if I do. Okay, we are live. So welcome, everybody, to Brain Food Live on Air. It is episode 33. I can't believe we've done 33 of these things. And we're going to keep with a habit of doing on-location Brain Food Lives. So I'm super excited today because I'm live from Sydney. That's the first bit of excitement for you. The second bit of excitement is that once again, Adam Gordon has been upgraded. So I'm delighted that he's no longer the permanent co-host of Brain Food Live, especially when I'm on tour. I'm very pleased to welcome my good friend, and general awesome all-round marketing goodie, Laura Johnson. Laura, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. My first podcast outing.
How can that be true? Is that actually the case?
I was waiting for the invite. I was like, I can't do anything until I've...
Oh, I see. Yeah. Brain Food Live has to be the initiation for people. Right. I totally agree. You can't go on any kind of media unless you come on here first. Anyway, Laura, great to have you on. For the people who don't know you, I just wonder whether you might share a little bit of information about who you are and what you do and who you do it for.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a head of marketing at Pass Technology, which is background screening. We've been in the UK for the last few years. We've just opened the office in Sydney. So I've been back in Sydney for 12 weeks, opening the office here. And Hung very kindly has been helping us out with some events this week. So we did a lunch with Rich and the guys at Smart Recruiters on Wednesday. And then we did a great event with JobAdder and the guys last night. So yeah, it's been a good week.
It was a great event, wasn't it? Really enjoyed it. You know what? There's so many smart people in this city, and so much interesting, so many interesting recruitment projects as well as recruitment tech. So it's you know, definitely one of those cities that's right up there. From the Brain Food audience, it's always been one of the top 10 cities in terms of numbers of people that subscribe to the newsletter.
Wow, awesome.
And yeah, there's about 300 people subscribed to it from here. It's great. It surprised me, but it's great. And I just wonder whether, and so obviously people who sign up for a newsletter is no barometer as to whether, you know, this is a go ahead city or not.
Yeah.
But if you look at the top 20 list of cities that are on there, they are all of the metropolitan centers that you might anticipate to have great HQs, great TA teams, and all the rest of it. So I'm very pleased to say Sydney is in the top five, I think, and more importantly, ahead of Melbourne. So, you know, Melbourneites need to step up the game and subscribe into Brain Food, I'm afraid, but Sydney is starting to track further forward. Anyway,
we're in Melbourne next week.
I am, yeah. So we're going to do this in Melbourne. We've got Ross Clement there and other folks that are going to be on the Melbourne side of things. So it'd be cool to kind of do the triple in Australia. Yeah. Anyway, Laura, quick one. We always start with a review of Recruiting Brain Food issue 156, I think it was last week. So the big question is, did you read it? And if you did, anything interesting caught your eye?
I always read it. No, so I picked three things. Am I allowed three?
You are allowed three. You allow more if you want, but three is good.
OK, Okay, so my three. So first one is just 30% of hiring success. I'm all over that.
Oh, hiring wow.
Last year was amazing. Cool. One of my favorite conferences.
Yeah, you go straight in to get the discount. I'll tell you something. Yeah, I'm going to give them a plug right now because they are not only giving me a 30% discount, but they also now is on the super early bird. So if you ever think this is a double discount, really. Yeah, so if you think about, you know what, I'm going to go to San Francisco and check out this conference, check out the event right now. That's definitely worth you doing.
Yeah. The guys did amazing last year. It was great. And the best conference food I've ever had. Just
you know what? Super important. I was at a conference earlier this year in Tallinn. A brilliant conference, great content, great speakers, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what? The only thing people were talking about was the food. Recruiters are very basic creatures, you know? You keep people fed and they're going to just be the amplification of that experience due to good food was massive. So it's weird and unfair, but I'm just thinking, you know what, get your catering right and people are going to just say warm things about their experience.
And not wild.
You know, save on the speaker fees, spend more money on the catering.
That was one. Two was the post around LinkedIn and the social sharing.
Which one was this one? Was this the mini blogging thing?
Yeah, it was just around. So I watched a separate webinar around it on Sunday as well. So I think it was just good timing. And I think it was just some great advice around how to get started. I think my big thing is I always overthink stuff. And I think there was a lot in there about just don't overthink it, just go with it and be natural and be normal. And I think that's a really great one. And I think the other stuff we were kind of looking at on Sunday around it was just around, you know, being consistent and being authentic. And I think sometimes you can lose that when you start over editing and overthinking what you're posting. So I think it's just a good go-to guide. Get started, just do it.
You know what? That was written by a friend of mine called Kasia Tang, who came on to Brain Food Live to talk about mini blogging actually on LinkedIn because she's really good at it. Yeah. And people might not know because she kind of does it all in Polish now. And because she's very keen on building the Polish market and so on. But she's also a very good writer in English. And yeah, her style is literally in her own voice. It's not trying to present some amazing bit of genius. Sometimes it's very clever, sometimes it's insightful, sometimes it's funny, but most importantly it's just her. And I think that's the message that she's trying to communicate. LinkedIn status updates is a massive media channel. I use it a lot. You can see actually my failure to do more LinkedIn since I've been traveling has had an impact on subscriber numbers on Recruiting Brain Food. So I can sort of attribute back. I mean, we're still getting 100 plus a week or so, but it should be 200 plus a week. And that's been driven, no doubt, by me writing, you know, a couple of paragraphs every week. On as a status update. I haven't done that last 2 weeks because basically I've been failing to manage my time. And this is true. I'm really bad at that.
You're busy exploring Australia and speaking at events every day.
I know, but still, it's unacceptable failure. But anyway, the point is, it drives huge amounts of traffic or it allows you to, in terms of your return to investment, it's massive. Because you're not putting a huge amount in. And one of the topics I would say for people who are listening to this and thinking about LinkedIn as a channel or content in general is that if you go with authenticity as a general rule, it actually becomes a whole lot easier to start writing and producing any kind of media. Because if you overthink, over-edit, what are people going to say, that kind of approach, it will firstly slow you down, so your speed to delivery is going to be compromised. Also, and I think most critically, it means that your effort goes up. So the amount of effort you put in goes up. Therefore, the amount of ROI you're looking at needs to be better, and you know it may not be, and it will demoralize you if it doesn't come back. So. Obviously, it's not a case of just writing crap out there and filling the airwaves with nothing. But if you've got something that you want to say, please come and just say it. If people don't like it, typically they're just going to ignore it. And so as long as just, you know, stay on the right side of the law, usually you're going to be okay. So anyway, I'd recommend people start doing that.
But I think, sorry, I was just going to say, the one thing that you mentioned there is just about measuring it. And it was one of the things brought up in the post. Like, if you know that it's having an impact and you're being authentic doing it, I think it just encourages you to do it. And you know that it's worthwhile, because it can be pretty time consuming, which I think is what puts people off. But if you know that your numbers are having that much of an increase and you can measure it, you're going to keep doing it.
Yeah, I tell you something, that actually underlines, and I want to underline the point that you've underlined for me, Laura, because it's super important. And I read this article about why speed was important. And, you know, startups are always talking about, yeah, move fast, break things. And people have now retreated from that and thinking, yeah, that's a terrible thing to do. But the real reason why you do want to move fast is because it basically means that every single bit of content you produce is lower risk and lower impact in terms of the effort that it takes. So if you do it quick, it basically means you're more likely to do it again because it didn't take that much time. But if you're one of these that needs to craft and redraft and, you know, really try and create a work of art, then that's crushing if you get 10 people viewing it, right? And you think, what is the point? But if you keep getting the stuff out at reasonable rates, reasonable volume, then I think it'll lower the cost to you, and it should increase the return as well.
That's true. Good point. Okay, third one.
Go ahead.
Was the next piece around UX design and where to get started.
Wow, that was a great post, wasn't it?
Loved it. We talked so much about it, and I think it's bringing that whole psychology and graphic design and what it means for a brand together. And I think we've spent so much time on it recently, and I just feel like I never understand it enough. So I think that post was just like, here's the theories, this is what they mean, and just giving you a highlight, but also telling you where to go for more information.
You know what? This was one of those posts which I love, because it comes from outside of the recruitment industry, and on the surface of it, it's not relevant to us. You know, a lot of people think, why am I looking at the psychology of UX? But the more I read into this, the more I realized, you know what? All of these laws, there's 7 laws that they put in, like principles of psychology.
Yeah.
Please read that article I've just shared, by the way, everyone. They basically said, I just thought, wow, this is totally applicable to like recruitment outreach messaging. You know, if I'm sending something to a candidate, probably I don't want to overwhelm that person with choices. But I do need to provide some choices, so that they can make a quicker decision. So you provide 3 choices, you know, the optimal number of choices that you want to provide. There's a one where you're talking about overwhelming people with information, like how much information is too much. And, you know, a lot of the mantra in recruitment messaging right now is that we need to hyper personalize, send a really, you know, what I think is a super long email, you know, overdoing the cheese, if you like. And I'm just thinking, you know what, sometimes that compromises one of the laws, one of the UX laws, that you're just really forcing too much in to a person who doesn't have time to consume it. So yeah, wonderful piece. And I don't think it will take too long for anybody to read it. And beautifully presented, right? You got lots of these little patterns and stuff. So Too Much Coffee, brilliant blog, by the way. So I tend to put stuff from Too Much Coffee into Brain Food. So go direct to source if you can't be bothered to subscribe to newsletter. Okay. Yes, indeed. Right. So what else was interesting, Laura? Was that it? Was there anything that annoyed you in last week's issue? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't think I got annoyed by anything. I think probably there was a few bits further down around blockchain and AI that I glazed over a little bit at. But that might just be my brain capacity for those things.
Yeah.
First two were a little bit kind of more marketing kind of sway, but also more topical to what we're doing as a business right now in terms of UX.
That's right, because you guys, Past Technologies, are going through a new market entry, and there's all kinds of new branding going on, all this super important stuff, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So we just launched a rebrand, so then it's a case of relooking at everything from a UX point of view. But I think, just obviously the more you learn, you're always tweaking UX, aren't you, in terms of the feedback we're getting, but also data and everything. So it's great to just try and understand it a bit more and get my head around it.
Can you, as a person that's always struggled with branding, and you can tell that by the state of my logo right now, it's literally a cartoon image of my face.
You're a good agency, I can hook you up.
You know what? Compliments to the designer, by the way. The designer did a great job, but I'm just conscious of the fact that this looks like super egotistical. So Past Technologies recently had a new logo, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell me, like, what was the process behind you choosing that? I mean, how did that work? Was it scientific or was it literally, you know what, I like the look?
So I think, like, when you think about branding, don't think about logos is probably where to start. Like, everyone thinks that, but we kind of, the reason we did it wasn't just because we wanted it to look a bit better, although that is really nice. It was about the fact that we'd launched into global offices, we've grown a lot as a business, we've changed a lot as a business in the last few years. So it was really more going back to who we are, what we stand for, what are our values, and how we want to grow. And it came down to a lot of kind of culture and bringing everybody on that journey. And that was the biggest bit of the rebrand. And it was a lot more about internal comms and talking to people about what we stand for now and what we're trying to achieve. So it was a lot of internal research, a lot of focus groups, a lot of questionnaires, and just a lot of time. We were spending time together and talking it through. And then just, you know, we're lucky enough that at the end, because we had a great agency that could take what we were saying and all that into aesthetically what we want to look like, and that all just kind of came together. But it was more about the bit before rather than the pretty logo.
You know what? That's probably the core takeaway, isn't it? Logo is the last thing you care about. It's important, but it's really about understanding whether you can be true to the brand that you're communicating. So brand is basically a shortcut to your company values, really, isn't it? What do you stand for? It's a flag to demonstrate that. You've got to understand what you stand for before you do anything.
Absolutely. Like, if you think about it, I think the best way someone describes brand is just like, it's every interaction every person ever has with you. So it's everybody says, everything they touch. And it's a much better way to look at it than how fancy is the logo.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, anyway, I like the look of it anyway. So you satisfy one idiot at least. and hopefully it will be, I'm sure it'll be a brand that will be following you guys around in the journey that you're on. Okay, so anyway, we're going to be talking about recruitment in Sydney, New South Wales, and in Australia. One of the things that I've really found to be super interesting in my travels is just to figure out what seems to be universal challenges in the industry, but also what are the local conditions which really make a difference between how people do the work of recruiting, what shapes the industry here. So I'm definitely keen to get your input on that, because Laura, you've worked in 3-4 countries now, right? So you've got lots of different comparatives, I think, that would love to bring in. And I want to bring in some of our guests as well, who also have got some good knowledge and experience as well. So first man up, let's see. I think this is Rich Lewis. Let's see if I can bring him on. Rich Lewis Jones, should I say. I think that's him. He just called himself Rich on here. So if it's a different Rich, we'll have him instead. But let's see if we can get our man from Smart Recruiters on here. Oh, something's happened.
There he is.
There he is. Good morning, hi. Richard. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I'm very, very good. How are you guys?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Good to see you, sir.
Is the sound all right? Check. Kind of.
You sound wonderful.
Perfect. That's great. Some good insights there from you guys. I actually just to back up Laura's point, the UX too much coffee article, I particularly enjoyed. Having worked at Boston Consulting Group and setting up their TA function.
Yep.
And then working with ventures and hiring for ventures there, and looking at ethnographic research, strategic design, human centered design, and just thinking about the UX of a product or a service before launching into market, and the difference that can make if you actually put the investment in time to do that properly, was really, really good. So that's a great article.
You know what, Rich? I just want to touch on that a little bit more, because one of the things that we don't think about in recruiting is the UX of the inbox of the candidate that we're dealing with. We just think, let's push an email into this guy's inbox, you know, and we're not thinking, how does that impact his day or her day? What is the experience that we're trying, that are we generating with this message? How long are we forcing this person to spend time reviewing our intrusion, right? All of these things we don't think about. We just think, let's push some marketing chat at him, or let's push some sales chat at him or her, and let's see whether we can get some sort of conversion.
it's also with hiring managers, right, as well. How many notifications are you sending them on a daily basis to remind them to give you interview feedback? It can be, you need to build bridges, not burn them. So it can be quite interesting. So yeah, it's certainly something to think about.
No, an interesting point again, Rich, because you've just reminded me of one of the many crises I had when I was working as a head of TA or as an internal recruiter. I say head of TA, but I was the only person there, so it's an overly grandiose title. But anyway, I remember one time when I was recruiting for a startup in London, rapid growth, classic, you know, hire as many developers as you can. And I remember how difficult it was to recruit those developers then. I finally found the person and the CTO. I thought, right, this is a guaranteed placement, guaranteed hire into the company. And I remember the CTO actually leaving the interview after 20 minutes of it starting. Oh. And you know, that dreaded thing where you see the hiring manager walk past your office. Yeah. You think that's not going well. And he stopped me and I said to him, hey, man, what happened? You know, this looked like a great candidate, yada, yada, yada. And you know what he said to me? He said, Hong, listen, I'm really sorry. I had to cut the interview short because I don't have time to do this interview. I really don't have the time to conduct this interview. And I had to reject the candidate and get out of there. This is what happened, right? So as a recruiter, I was fuming. It's like, do you not realize that I've put all of this work in to get this person in, highly valued person in the market? We're not going to see him again as a candidate. We can't bring him back. He's off to somewhere else. And I was furious for a moment. But then I stopped and thought, you know what? There's nobody more interested in hiring for his team in this business than the CTO, the hiring manager, right? He wants it more than me, really. But I had created an experience for the hiring manager which forced him to make this impossible decision between doing this interview and doing his job.
Don't blame yourself.
No, it's totally my responsibility, man.
Right.
Because I had basically created a recruitment system which produced too much assessment load for the hiring manager.
Right.
I was asking too much from the hiring manager because he couldn't do it. He literally couldn't do it. And going back now and know the history, it was totally right he couldn't do it. We had a crisis that needed to be plugged.
But how, with that, how do you, the way I think about something like that, though, is if he'd have spent another 20 minutes with that candidate and then said thanks, but no thanks, and then to you, don't have time, what about the impact that that would have had on your brand as a person, your brand as a business? I think, you know, one of the mindsets that I always had when I was in TA is I want to make sure that every candidate that either walks through our door, speaks to me or a hiring manager on a phone, or even gets rejected at the application stage, knows where they stand and has some form of positive experience. Because especially in that London community, when all that candidate needed to do was go to Silicon Drinkabout or something like that and go and talk to however many thousands of developers that might have been at that, and then just spread the word that Hung Lee is. I'll joke.
The accurate assessment that Hung Lee is incompetent at this. I totally get what you're saying. And Mark has stepped up as well to hammer the CTO. I get it. You know, you speak to anybody now and looking at this and you think, right, the hiring manager is our fault. What I'm trying to say is the responsibility is ultimately mine because I'd engineered a situation which caused this hiring manager to fail. I should have understood the schedule better. I should have understood the business better. And more importantly, I should have engineered the recruitment system that didn't ask for the hiring manager to do too much work on the assessment side. So we flipped it. I mean, basically, we just changed the way in which we assess candidates and we didn't do the sequential, you know, technical interview, face-to-face interview. We just didn't do all of that because we realized that actually increased the assessment load for the hiring managers to the point where we couldn't tolerate it. And we subsequently become a much more successful business recruiting those people. But the bottom line is it's about the experience that we give to the people we interface with and getting some design thinking, some of this UX understanding. You can apply it beyond the logos. You apply it to how people experience your relationship.
Yeah, it's interesting. You've got brands out there, small and large, that I've been in conversations where people are turning around and saying, when a candidate applies for a job at our business, how do we automate it so that we don't have to speak to them until they start on day one? And that's everything from assessments, video interviews, automated interview scheduling, all that kind of stuff, chatbots at the screening stage, culture assessment tools, all of that. So I think the possibilities are there to create that kind of stuff, but like around experience. But the next part of that for me is the how do you make sure that that remains human? Or how do you humanize technology or use technology that is human-led, that human-centered design to deliver that experience? Otherwise, it's just like people turning up for work on day one asking for Olivia, and that's a chatbot.
Yeah, I mean, I get this. I get it as well, you know. Yeah. But at the same time, I would also say we might overestimate how much people want to deal for the people. Like one of the controversies we often see is that we believe that over automation is necessarily worse than having lots of humans in there. But we've had lots of humans, and recruitment is a horrible experience for people. I remember there's a tech startup out of Sweden, which I talk about all the time, and I'm going to talk about them again. This is Tengai, the animatronic head.
It looks a bit like me.
It does. The reason why I like these guys, firstly, is because they've literally gone for it. You know, forget about automation and all this fake software. No, they've actually got a puppet, and it's going to talk to you. They've got a robotic thing. It's there.
Surreal.
It's surreal. I had the same reaction as everyone. It was like the WTF reaction. Like, what on earth? How is this ever going to be a great experience? But then I listened to what the thinking was behind it. And the thinking is simply, we want to provide candidates with the option of speaking to the robot instead of a human. Because there's going to be some people that might prefer that. Even if it's one person that might prefer that, having the option is a good thing. And then I started thinking, who might prefer this? And it turns out, you think people who've experienced prejudice, let's say, you're an immigrant or an asylum seeker in Sweden, you're trying to get a job. Would this person prefer to speak to a robot or a Swedish person? What about someone who is not comfortable in interview? Of which there are lots of people, right?
Yeah.
We think that because we're recruiters, we're in here, marketers as well, we're very comfortable face-to-face, et cetera, for us, natural environment. But you know what? I would imagine a lot of people are horrified by the prospect of having to meet with somebody they don't know and then sharing quite intimate work details. So then I start thinking along these lines and thinking, you know what? It's no harm, no foul. You've got the option. No one's being forced to speak to this thing.
Yes.
Candidates have the choice. You choose one way or the other. And there's a bunch of people choose to speak to the robot.
Yeah. It'd be a totally different experience if it was someone that was making redundancies and it was a robot.
Right.
You know, like that's where it starts getting difficult. I think we've all seen that film Up in the Air with George Clooney. You know, if someone needs to do that face to face, even if you outsource it. If you do it through a robot, I don't think that robot would be in one piece for very long.
So, you know what? Maybe the provision of bad news doesn't need to take human ownership of it. I tend to agree. But I would recommend everyone check out Tengai and Bias. I think they're going to go far. So we're here to talk about Australia, man.
Yeah.
Let's talk about sort of Sydney in particular. It's the capital of the country. 5 million people, 4.5 million people, I think. What is the sort of status of Sydney, if you like, of the Sydney market? I mean, is it approximate to London versus UK? Is it that way in this country? How do you see it?
Of the way that we deliver recruitment, or
exactly. What is the recruitment like in this city specifically?
So I moved from London 5 years ago, sort of from a TA role into a new TA role. I think one of the things that I found most interesting for me, there was heaps of appetite for new ways of thinking, but a lot of businesses at that time, I would say 5 years ago, were thinking very locally. So in Australia and New Zealand, we love local. We absolutely love local businesses. I think people like that face-to-face interaction, whether you're a vendor, whether you're a recruitment agency, whether you're an RPO delivering. I think it's a really nice thing. I think what was interesting for me, having turned up and seen different tools over in the UK that I'd used that weren't even here yet. So I think there's an appetite for change, I think, but we've moved into a movement where people are very open to trying new technologies. When I talk about people like local, they also like things that were like hosted here locally, like cloud, SaaS. It's all like quite a new thing. Some people on the call might think differently, but I certainly believe that some of the conversations that I have, having been in TA and now on the vendor side, you see a little bit more, people being a lot more comfortable with looking outside of Australia. So I think, you know, even to your point around to your recruiting brain food, I think it was a breath of fresh air. I think people have always looked inside Australia for what's going on, with a select few people that were looking outside of what was happening in the States, what was happening in like the UK and Europe. And I think with things like your newsletter, with people kind of getting more budget to go out to events and seeing the return on investment in things like technology already, it's certainly an area that everyone's looking at.
What do you think about that, Laura? Do you think that's an accurate sort of description of the Aussie market, so to speak? It's kind of perhaps for the geographical isolation, it's always kind of have its own sort of a vision of it being locked in this area, but now it's starting to expand more internationally.
Yeah, I've not been here as long as Rich, so I can't say anything, but I do think his point around the fact that everyone wants to change and people are looking for options, I think is really true. And I think that's one of the reasons HR Tech's done so well here over the last few years is because the market's really open to having discussions and talking to each other and working together, which I think is a hugely positive thing. And people will have a coffee and have a discussion and have a chat about what you're doing. It's not just like, no, we do it this way or we do this. And I think that is why the market's so great here.
I think it's, especially the Aussies and the Kiwis are quite competitive. I don't know how many Kiwis and how many Aussies are on this call, but the Kiwis seem to be the ones that will dive in first. The Australian organisations are much more, can you provide me with 3 references of organisations that are using your product first, even if you're new to market? Whereas the Kiwis would be that I'll take the plunge, I'll be the person, I'll be the innovator, the disruptor, I'll use this tool. So I think that's quite interesting. I think being a vendor that's just arrived and just opened an office here for smart recruiters, I think one of the most interesting things for us is we're quite a lean business. So being able to provide, I can understand the nervousness and the comfort that businesses would need to know that when the shit hits the fan, who can I speak to get this fixed? So it's, you know, any business now in a cloud or SaaS solution, if I was to turn around and say, well, you know, our support team are all the way in America and you're probably going to have to wait 15 hours to speak to someone, that's just not going to fly. Like last year, LinkedIn, or it was either last year or the year before, LinkedIn posted an article about the most in-demand jobs, and customer success managers came in above data scientists and engineers.
I
think in this market we are so demanding, but quite rightly, people want tech and they want it to work. And I think it's because businesses are becoming really passionate about candidate experience, about employee experience, and I think, you know, making sure that you've got the technology in place that does that, but when it doesn't work, that there's people there that you can speak to, not necessarily immediately, but there is some form of really solid, comfortable SLA that they can actually respond to. And I think that's absolutely critical here. We wouldn't have a business if we couldn't do that. You know, and there's so many good startups, so many HR tech tools that have such great local teams here. And I think a huge part of their success is not just about their product, it's about their actual customer success and their post-sales organization.
I think on that, like if you can go onto a platform and be able to put your credit card in and buy a platform, like straight up and use it, but then you can't get help if something goes wrong. Like people are going to get paid, and rightly so. So your support needs to match however easy it is to buy your product and use your product. That's what we expect. Like in general, and I think people are getting more demanding just as access to information comes quicker and easier. But just having, like you say, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a person all the time, but then some information or something that people can help themselves, and then you've got a decent SLA to get back to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think on the recruitment agency side, part of me, having moved here 5 years ago, wish that I'd moved out here to do recruitment agency, because people are so friendly here. Like, amount of times during the recession in London that I used to bring people up and say, can I have a coffee? I think we got told no about 200 times a day. Here, everyone's like, yeah, sure, you can buy me a coffee, you can buy me lunch, and you can go there and have a decent conversation. It's very relationship-led here. And I think if I was on the recruitment agency side...
You'd kill it here, right? big fella Rich Lewis.
Yeah, I should have moved here a long time ago, but no, it's fine. It's all good. It's great for that. I think, you know, businesses are really open to meeting with RPOs, meeting with agencies, and really opening up. Those that don't open up to the agency, I like to, rather than call people a third party, it's a third arm of your business. You need to actually communicate and build a relationship with that person or that product or service as if they're a part of your business. If you don't do that, it's just a ticketing system. Do not expect great results. And I think the agencies feel that, vendors feel that, everyone's kind of benefiting from that kind of thriving environment that we've created here.
You know what? That's a really kind of it feels like a paradise for recruiters here, which is maybe why there's so many Brits and Irish recruiters are actually doing the job, which is another actually significant sort of noticeable feature of the recruitment landscape here, that it does seem to be dominated by, or at least there's an overwhelming number there's a larger than there should be, if you like, number of Brits and Irish recruiters here. And I wonder whether that is because that people have seen that, you know, it's a market that needs a little bit or at least, you know, I wouldn't say it's an easier market to sell those services in, but perhaps the style of operating in the UK might be very suitable for the market in Australia.
Yeah, a few other reasons that we're all here rather than the UK too, if it helps.
I'm going to actually invite on a local recruiter now, actually, who might be able to give us a little bit of insight on that as also. This is Mark Mansour. I'm not sure whether he's actually going to be on the mobile app or on the desktop. But Mark, I've just invited you, so check out whatever email you've signed up on, and hopefully you can come in. If not, we can try again. Oh, there he is. Mark, how are you doing, sir?
What is happening, people?
How are you?
Good, good. I find it hilarious that you're running a recruitment brain food session on the Australian market and you got two POMs as your guest, right? The irony is ridiculous.
This is why we need you, man. This is why we need you, Mark. You are our token Aussie.
My ear repping the Aussies.
That's it. Sorry, Mark, having heard what Laura and Rich said about, you know, how the Aussie market looks from their perspective, they're also Brits and also vendor side as well. I just wanted to get your view as a person that's obviously born, bred and worked all the way through in the Australian market. How do you see that characterization, and have you got anything to add to that?
No, like I was trained up by POMI recruiters and they came, you know, fresh out of the London market. And for me, that meant there was a lot of opportunity to see growth and ways to improve things because, you know, to Rich's point, the Aussie market from an agency perspective is massively relationship focused, right? You get in, you build good rapport with people, you can do some great things. But at the same time, there's a lot more visibility now when you're looking at the likes of, you know, LinkedIn, everyone's visible, right? What I'm seeing is the difference between the agencies I've engaged with and the ones that I won't engage with are the ones that try to go that step further and engage with the brand that I'm representing, right? So, mate, yesterday I had a call from an agency on my mobile and the guys just jumped straight into a pitch. And I'm like, wait, hold on, just one second. You're calling me to see if you can recruit for me. Yes, I'm no longer at that business, mate. You know, I said, but, you know, word to the wise, don't call them like first time you're reaching out to someone, call on their mobile. It's the worst thing you can do, right? I don't know you. You know, you've not sent me a text. You've not, you know, sent an email. You've not, there's been nothing. So, yes, very relationship driven. Yes, always happy to go catch up for a coffee, but don't pitch on the first date. You know, it's that dating analogy.
Yeah,
don't go for the home run on the first contact.
I think in the defense of lots of recruitment agencies are out there as well. I think you're, Mark, one of those people that would be open to having a coffee. I think especially with the recruitment agency market being sort of fairly saturated, there's a lot of agencies here. They really are sort of Australia wide.
It's and 40,000, obviously, it's, I think.
It's quite hard, isn't it? You know, I know that there'll be lots of MDs and senior recruiters who sit there and say, how many times have I emailed someone though and said, I'd love to learn about your business?
Yep.
And they've turned around and said, that's great, but I'm too busy. So yep. their next approach is to kind of send a CV that says, here's candidate XYZ, actually says that at the top. I've taken their name off. They're great for your business. I used to get that in London when I moved from agency. I used to do that and I moved into TA and then realised the frustration with that. So I think there's a balance of agencies that really want to reach out and meet to people. In my eyes, that I work in sales. If you reach out to someone and you say, I want to learn about your business, because I feel that if I learn about your business, I can drive impact and give you return on investment and bring amazing talent into your business. If they turn around and say no, forget it and move on, because they're just not going to be someone you want to work with anyway.
100%.
It's just move on. If you're opening up the conversation saying, I really want to learn and really want to know all about your business so I can help drive impact and make you look good to your peers and your bosses, if they say no to that, then fair enough. That's their problem. It's if you say I can do that and you don't deliver it, then it's your fault. I do feel for the agencies and vendors out there that kind of do go out there and say that and then get the no's and then take it on their own. It's not your fault. It's actually their fault. If those people aren't willing to open up to you, they're not worth working with. It's really, really hard. Or at least spend time to try and get to that point. But yeah, it can suck sometimes to some people.
I just want to address a comment that Jason has mentioned there, and he called it's a cultural aversion to calling. Do you feel that's true in Australia in the sense people don't want to pick up the phone? And is this the reason why there is an overwhelming number of Brit recruiters here? Because maybe they've been trained down now for an outside line.
Well, just hang on. I'm not sure if you're aware. They changed the migration legislation here in Australia. It was probably about 12 months ago.
That's right.
Which meant there was a huge difference in terms of the salaries they were offering. Back in the day, you know, they used to get away with hiring people from the UK for 60 to 70K as a base, and now they've got a minimum requirement of 90. So that means OTEs are down a little bit, and there's a few perks that, you know, used to be had that are no longer available to be offered. So it's tougher for, you know, to hire people from the UK here unless they've got a visa, and they're exceptionally good. What I've seen more recently is a lot of agencies hiring Aussies who've come from the likes of Fitness First, or they've come from like a real estate background, because they've done that hard graft. And so people are actually trying to train their recruiters up. The unfortunate reality with that, though, am I dropping in and out? Is that just my computer freaking out again?
Nice. The screen's dancing around a fair lot. That's all right.
Yeah, that's not me. I thought it was me just going, yo.
Wow, that's crazy. I'm kind of
getting...
Yeah. Wait, I
think it's back. No.
Hello.
I'll tell you
this,
what, Mark.
I say, what, Mark?
It's a wonderful product.
Yeah, so I think something's happened here, which is going really nuts. But Mark, what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of kick you off the call and then get you back on and then see if that helps.
That's right.
So let me do that and then see what happens, because that's kind of making me dizzy. There we go. But yeah, some really good input from Mark there. Super interesting to get his view as to especially that legislative change. Obviously, it's one of those local conditions that we should be aware of. There was a big kind of barrier come down. Was that right? And yeah. Then can you two explain that to me? Well, we'll figure out how to get Mark back on.
So it was Oh, when was it? It was last year, 2 years ago. I was affected by it. I was on a 457 visa. They changed the legislation on 457 visas. I think that's another reason why a lot of people came out to Australia. You could migrate to Australia on a highly skilled migrant visa as a, which is a 457 or one of those types of visas, in a recruitment consultancy role. So I think it was a ticket to paradise. I think that was probably one of the big changes that that brought that in. I know that everyone was like, oh my God, what? You know, you're going to have to pay someone a 90K, a 95K base in a recruitment agency role.
Stop a sec there, Rich. Basically, the law stipulated that you would not get this visa unless there was salaried to a certain level. Is that correct?
So they scrapped the 457 altogether, I believe. So the 457 got scrapped. So I was engaged to an Australian and I moved straight onto a partner visa, although I was getting dragged out by my ear. So some people say it was a strategic move, but it wasn't. it got scrapped. And obviously lots of people, unless you were in the same job for 3 years and had a degree, you were out. So I hadn't been in the same job for 3 years because I was at XREF at that time. So lots of people were affected by it. I know lots of people that had to leave.
I
had a friend that was a personal trainer. He had to move, he had to leave. So it was tough. But I think, I don't know what the new visa was, but you could bring them in at 90K or above. And I thought agencies weren't going to do it. So some agencies were getting just great recruiters and paying them the earth and bringing them out. And fair play, if you knew they were going to deliver and there's a loophole, why not? It's one of those things. But to be honest, I don't think the Australian recruitment agency market has taken a hit in that sense, has it, Mark? I wouldn't say it's not like everyone's gone, oh my God, now all of a sudden no one can hire. You know, the economy is faltering because of it. I don't think it is, but I think it's obviously not great news for anyone that's outside of recruitment agencies.
What I've seen the last couple of weeks, I've heard the R word way too many times. You know, it's not like 150 times I've read recession in the market, and I've spoken to a fair few like people I know in the agency realm, and they're still going all guns blazing. So there are some organizations out there who have overhired and they're slowing down, but there are others that are just continuing to grow. So I think we're fortunate. There are so many different segments and the startup community is doing rather well here. There's a lot of, you know, really cool organizations like Antler who are doing some amazing things at the moment. There's a lot of VC backed businesses that are doing a lot of growth. There's, you know, the VC community, what I'm starting to see more of is almost like a shared service model beginning to occur. So they'll have the VC having a team of internal recruiters hiring for the businesses that they back. And so I think there's still an appetite for businesses in Australia to do the majority of their work direct. What I've seen as someone who the last 8 years has been internal is we're getting stretched as an internal recruiter, getting stretched further and further. Now, if you're in a SME, you're wearing so many different hats. It's not funny. So you're wearing sourcing hat, you're wearing branding hat, you're wearing culture hat, you're wearing like everything. You've got to do everything and you're limited to yourself. So it's hard being that fast stretch. It's exhausting. You're putting in some ridiculous hours and you may be working in a flexible working environment, be working with the best business, but there is so much that needs to be done. And we're like, you know, I found in my last role, I was getting pulled into doing culture related activities and, you know, that's exhausting.
Is that lack of resource or lack of budget or both?
I'd say that both is the easiest way to answer that question. Right. But I think there's an expectation from the business. It's probably something that we all could do a fair bit better with is articulating what it is that we actually do. Because I think that's a massive, I know I've found it hard in the past to try and articulate what it is I'm actually doing with the business, because sometimes you don't get the face time with your C-level execs, right? I think that's, so for SIDREC Meetup, one of the sessions we'll end up running in the next few months is going to be about engaging with your senior stakeholders. How do you get that seat at the table? All right. Mm-hmm. And when you're there, what is it that you need to be able to articulate to them to be able to ensure that you stay there and you remain there and you're seen as that trusted provider of advice and guidance? Because that's what we are. Like, we've got our finger on the pulse. We know more about, you know, the people that are in the business. And this is going to be very controversial, which, you know, oh, I know how, you know, how rare for Mark to be controversial. But we know more about the people in the business than HR. Right, talent acquisition has a finger on the pulse, because when you brought new people into the business, they come back to you as their trusted person there, their trusted advisor, right? And so you, like, I know for myself, I can speak on my behalf, when I've had people join businesses, when I've hired people and sourced them and brought them into the business, I stay in touch with them. We catch up for coffees, for lunch, and you hear about how they're finding things, right? And you, that's amazing, but the business won't take the time to sit down and converse. Right, because the business is always busy.
But is that come just from the personal experience and kind of what we're doing at Smart Recruiters? Is lots of people can view, especially CEOs, CFOs, view TA, HR as a cost center. And that's generally speaking because they'll turn around every year and say that this is the budget that I need for tools, hiring, advertising. I think sometimes some businesses will say, well, we've spent enough. We hired, we hit our hiring numbers. We only just went over our budget or actually came in under it. But no one, but then what happens is then you just repeat that model. What we're trying to get people to actually talk about is whether you're a business that doesn't have enough budget or has a current budget that you're kind of fairly satisfied with. Don't be content. Look at the actual impact that's having on your business right now and what it could potentially get you to. If you were to increase that budget, invest in the right technology, perhaps there might even be an agency out there that you're generally charging agencies, or, you know, agencies might be charging you 12, 13, 14%. What if you actually had this agency over here that has amazing candidates, but you paid them 18, 19, 20% for an, you know, for some form of exclusivity? So just trying to get people to kind of reverse engineer that mindset of, you know, what is the business impact that engaging this vendor or engaging this agency, whatever it might be, can have on our business if we invest in it appropriately. And it's not an easy thing to do because obviously they need the right tools to be able to do that. But again, I think if you truly can build a partnership with an agency, with an RPO, with a vendor, and really open up your books to say, this is what I would like to do. There is a dog on the line, right, okay.
Wanted attention.
Then it will then you'll have massive impact. So you can actually go to a CFO or a CEO and say, hang on a minute, well, last year we hired all of these people. Our hiring time went from 45 to 21 days, and that's great. However, we actually needed those people 6 weeks ago every time we hired them. So it's, I think there's just a changing conversation that needs to happen, but you need to be able to partner with the right people to do that.
On that note, go ahead, Laura.
So just on partnering with the right people, I think Mark's point in the beginning just about how does HR work with the other business units, I think especially in SME, like what can HR work with marketing on to help with culture and recruitment, marketing and branding and all that? So how can they bring marketing on that? What can they learn from finance in terms of reporting and Rich's point about time to hire and stuff? I think like everyone in SME, especially like startup, you're all trying to do a bit of everything. So I think it's how we can all work better to make sure that it's all elevated rather than kind of HR sits here, marketing sits here, finance sits here. Like we've got the opportunity at that point when we're small enough that we can do that. And hopefully then as we grow, you kind of that's.
Michael Delaney, who I might actually bring on screen here, he's actually said something very interesting about, you know, we're measured on KPIs and because we accept the measurement, we end up struggling to have those kind of conversations, because if we accept that we're going to be judged on time to hire, all those types of classic recruitment measurements, then we're really going to struggle to be strategic, because those aren't necessarily strategic things.
They're old metrics. You need to look at quality. You need to look at what we call hiring velocity. So it's not your time to hire. It's actually how quickly you're getting these people on board, in terms of like, did you actually get them on board on time ahead of when you needed them? It's the old time to hire, and cost is just old school. You need to look at speed, quality, and then the actual business outcome that has.
Yeah.
You're talking about, it's because a lot of, again, this is going back to C-level execs not understanding what we do, right? And we're getting viewed, say, internal recruiters are perceived or viewed as just an extension of an agency as well. So there's not that value being seen. Even though there's so much work going on, the value isn't being seen by the business. And it's just, again, not being able to articulate what it is you're doing. So it's this never-ending circle, right? So it's a tough habit to try and break, but it's something that needs to be done because we're seeing it in the HR space, right? People aren't using that term, you know, human resources anymore. So, you know, everyone's trying to move towards people or people operations or people in culture. So terminologies are changing, just the same thing as recruiter versus talent acquisition or people going much more specific in their titles. It's showing that level of depth and understanding.
On that note, guys, I just want to say one thing. The rebranding of recruiter to talent acquisition might have been an attempt by our industry to renegotiate our position internally, because we didn't want, we understood that the perception was too low for us to have genuine impact. I've got a problem here because I want to bring on Michael Delaney, but I've got to kick one of you guys off.
I'll jump off. This. I'm sure you're sick of my head.
No, stay on. Rich, I'm gonna let you go for a time being.
That's all good.
Stay here, though. I'll bring you back on because I've got a feeling Michael hasn't got a huge amount of time. But because he's mentioned so many good things here, I'm going to bring him on quick and then see what he's got to say.
Awesome. Good stuff.
You don't have enough time, mate. He's got Delaney's one of my favorites. You think I'm out there. Delaney's up there. I love him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I miss Mike, actually. I totally forgot he's in Sydney. So we should catch up. So, but I'm going to bring him on now, see if he's appropriately dressed. I cross fingers, I hope. it's not a foregone conclusion with Delaney. And hopefully we'll get him on because he's got some great experience as agency and in-house. And some of his comments here have been really quite cool, especially about, you know, how do we accept these measures? There he is. Michael, how are you doing, sir?
Hey, gang. I am very appropriately dressed in a red cherry shirt with a dark gray fedora, as every stylish recruiter should be wearing on a Friday.
That's it. So if anybody doesn't know Michael Delaney, his sartorial standards setting it right up there. But Michael, great to speak to you. You're obviously outside, and I don't want to take and this is unplanned, so if you've got other stuff to do, do let me know. But you mentioned a couple of things super interesting here, particularly about perception of sort of in-house recruiters. How do you renegotiate a stronger position with the business? And get away from being kind of measured by all of these all KPIs that kind of damage the standing of the function?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's a process I'm going through literally as we speak. So I've worked startups since 2007. And so when you get brought into a startup, you know, it's just the, hey, do recruitment, hire a bunch of people. And in this current role I'm in, I did that for the last 18 months. You know, we quadrupled in size, everyone was really happy. But the GM I discovered had zero idea of what I actually did. So I had to sit down with him and walk him through literally step by step everything that I was doing for him and his business. And once I started to put it in business rationality, in terms of, you know, the projects that we weren't delivering on because of headcount, the cost to the bottom line of the business, the schedule boards, the latency on delivery. I had to speak his language. And so I didn't even use talent acquisition or any terminology like that. I had to use his physical business terms. So it was about productivity, customer outcomes, customer experience, and the metrics underpinning his business, which I then just hide hiring and people too. So we went right away from anything. I mean, my role covers, because I'm in an SME, I do training, I do onboarding, I do coaching, I do bid preparations. So I'm in a slightly special situation in that result. But I think as a result, it's really given me an insight into what the business is trying to achieve from its numbers. And then I just found ways to dovetail myself onto that.
Yeah, I think that's a critical point, isn't it? Like we're kind of locked a little bit into our own terminology and our own way of thinking about things. But actually, if we really want impact at the C-level, we have to learn their language and operate with them. So great that you shared that example with us, Mike. If you've got a young recruiter out there, and they're, because oftentimes recruiters do come in at a fairly junior level, and they're often the one person in a business before it grows bigger and you need more. So they're used to operating at a lower level. What advice would you give if they heard that and thought, that's great, Mike, but can you give me some like quick how to's? Like, how do I get better at speaking to CEOs? What would you say to that person?
So there's three things I'd suggest they do, because everything should be done in threes. So the first thing they need to do is understand their business model, as in the business they work in, right? So if you're a retail shop, what does the shop actually do? How does it make money? You might be able to find that in a, you know, an AGM report or a stock report or whatever, but get into that and be able to talk to that. The second thing they have to do is sit down with the management and go through a life in their day, not their recruitment day, you know, not what do you want from your people, but literally a day in the life of their success or failure. And then the third thing you have to have is build your own stories that you can tell that layer that back in. And that's probably the bit that's the hardest to do, because we're focused on outcomes. You know, when's that interview? Have we got an offer out? You don't really have the time. But you've got to make the time to tell compelling stories that are underpinned by the business outcomes and by the management actual success metrics. And if you do that, and that'll only take you 2 to 3 to 5 years potentially, but if you do that, you should be able to get into the senior leaders and speak the way they want to hear it.
Michael, that's amazing. That's brilliant. I want you to write those three points down and stick it out somewhere, because I think people should read that. That was really a practical advice on what you should do, and so well expressed as well. So thank you very much for sharing that, Michael.
Anytime. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Listen, I know you're busy and you've got a very busy week. I don't think we're going to get the time to catch up. I'm free, but I know you're not. But you let me know if you've got a window.
I will see you next week though at Wreckfest, mate.
Are you coming?
You bet.
All right.
And wait till you see the outfits,
dude.
Because I obviously have to have more than one.
I know. And listen, mate, you've set the standards this high last time I saw you. So if it's not like exceeding those, I'll be devastated.
Oh, mate, I will live up to it. Don't you worry.
All right. Listen, great to speak to you, mate. Let me let you go. I'll see you next week, buddy.
No worries. Thanks, guys.
Great. Cool. How cool was that? I thought that was a brilliant description of what you got to do. I mean, it wasn't a prescription, but it was like, hey, here are three things. And it made absolute sense to me. So fabulous on that. Let me share another thing that I wanted to put into Brain Food, but I haven't had the time. This is a post by a lady called Julie Evans, who's one of the best bloggers, I think, in the tech world. So she's, a DevOps person or somebody in the Valley. She's not very big on LinkedIn and like that. She's super technical. But she writes amazing blogs. And one of the things that she was talking about, that actually in software, people often have the same problem. In other words, people don't understand the function and they don't understand the value or the contribution that person's making. And she just said, hey, listen, it's possible to write a brag document, which is a way of, you know, to Michael's point, how do you tell the story of your job? And you do that in such a document that is helping other people understand what you do, helping people understand your contribution, and kind of just making sure that resonates with where the business is going. And it seems to me that that's easily adoptable practice for anybody in business that might be worth us to do. A CEO could do this, and it would be a positive thing for the business, I think. So I've just shared that link into the chat stream there. So I'd encourage people to check that out if they have time. Okay, listen, I mean, we've had a great chat. We're over time already. I want to bring sort of Rich back on, but to be honest with you, I'm going to kick everyone else off because we've come into the end of the show. So I just want to thank everyone for joining me with this. Thank you to Rich Lewis-Jones for your amazing contributions earlier. Mark Mansour, thank you for coming on. What's the name of your dog, by the way, sir?
That was Snowy, and Coco was passed out in her bed, mate, so I couldn't...
Right, okay, yeah. Well, say goodbye to Snowy for me and to Coco, and I'll hopefully see you later. Laura...
We're going to go for Ledford, yeah?
Yeah, in case people didn't realise... Mark Mansour is Palestinian Lebanese, so we're gonna have some great food tonight. So yeah, I'll see you later, buddy. And Laura, thank you so much for joining me as co-host. You've been fantastic. It's been a great show talking about Sydney. Next week, I think we're all gonna be in Melbourne for Wreckfest. So someone quickly share the Wreckfest link into the chat stream. I will be there, and we're gonna be back with another Brain Food Live from Melbourne. On Friday, and we'll be joined by Andrea Kirby if she's still not too hungover after the big day. Some other stragglers from the event, and also Ross Clennon is going to join us as well then, which I'm very excited to hear because he's been a big fan of Recruiting Brain Food, big promoter, and also one of the best, I think, commentators in the Australian scene. So I will see you all next week. Thank you all for listening.
Thanks for having me on, mate. Awesome show.